This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. This is the author speaking to you. My name is John Hodgman. This book is dedicated to Eileen Callahan Hodgman. This is the beginning. The bookkeeper for the Church of Satan. First of all, I apologize for my beard. Not only because it is terrible, thin, patchy, and asymmetrical, but also because it is inexplicable. Many people have asked me why I grew it, and most of those people are my wife. And to them and to her I say, I don't know. And I'm sorry. Before my beard, I just had a mustache, and that was not mysterious at all. In fact, I have grown two mustaches in my life, for equally banal and emotionally transparent reasons. I grew the first one in 1999 in the year-long run-up to my marriage to the woman who is still my wife. I had only ever been clean-shaven before then, aside from an obligatory early 90s flirtation with a soul patch in college. And I suppose now I was testing her. A few very good-looking people I know turn mean when they drink, mocking and abusing the people who care about them. They make themselves ugly to see if people will still love them that way. I think my mustache, thick and dark and unwanted in the middle of my round, pale face, served the same function, to be repulsive on purpose. I looked like a bushy 19th century president who also happened to be a baby. Luckily, my then fiancé, whom I have known since high school and who had already seen me through various thicks and thins, did not take the bait. She did not confirm my fear that I was an unlovable fraud, and did not decline to marry President Chester A. Baby. So I shaved off my mustache the morning after my bachelor weekend in a dilapidated mansion in Atlantic City that I had rented with a group of friends. I cannot remember whether this was my decision or her command. Maintaining such fogginess about free will is, I think, a secret to a lasting marriage. And ours has lasted. You have the numbers in front of you, so you can do the math. I've never been very good with subtraction, especially with odd numbers, like 1999 and 2017. I grew my second and currently enduring mustache in 2011. By that time, my wife and I had two children, whose actual names will never be revealed. As you know, I've always hesitated to talk about my children and, when pressed, would refer to our daughter only as Hodgmina, and our son as Hodgmanillo. In the past, I've said this is to protect their privacy, and that is true of our son, who is, as of this writing, still young enough to like us. There are many joys of parenting, but, ultimately, we are robots, training our own upgrades to replace us. But my son doesn't know this yet. He doesn't know that his job is to grow and thrive apart from us and conspire with time in our destruction. He still holds our hands and does not treat us like we are hopelessly stupid, and so I wish to protect him. But Hodgmina is now a luminously smart teenager with a strong social media presence who I think would enjoy being named in this book, so I am keeping her anonymous to spite her. I love her. I hope, of course, that she will outlive me. These are the kind of fun hopes you nurture when you get older. But I do not need to help her outpace me in fame. Insecurely teasing a teenager is a privilege of fatherhood. And I grew my second mustache for the same reason all your weird dads grew theirs. It is an evolutionary signal that says, I'm all done. A mustache sends a visual message to the mating population of Earth that says, no thank you. I have procreated. My DNA is out in the world, and so I no longer deserve physical affection. Instead, it is time for me to turn away from sex and toward new pursuits, the classic weird dad hobbies such as puns and learning trivia about bridges and wars and dreaming about societal collapse and global apocalypse. All dads dream about the end of the world. It is a comfort to them. For some, the fantasy is blunt, vengeful, and aspirational. The zombie epidemic story, as one example, is consistently popular for a very clear and simple reason. When chaos consumes civilization, you get to start over. You get to be young again. All your debts, real and emotional, are canceled. Whatever your dumb job used to be, it has now been replaced with the sole exciting occupation of survival via crossbow or samurai sword. You get to dress up and wear armor or an eye patch, and since your neighbors now have been transformed into the idiot monsters you always believed them to be, the zombie epidemic offers you finally moral permission to shoot them in the head. This is not my fantasy, by the way. Now, I've always thought that if The Walking Dead really wanted to provoke horror, its last season would time jump 5 years to a future in which the government reforms and the zombies have been cured, aside from the ones that our heroes decapitated. And all the characters have to get those dumb jobs again, and the humans will have to work alongside the horribly mutilated, cured zombies, and think about what they did and what they became in order to survive. And they think about this while they all sit around in the break room together with their reheated soups. That said, I don't want to sound snobby about zombies. I get it. If there were a zombie show that just featured the characters endlessly raiding supermarkets for canned goods and then stocking those cans neatly back in their compound pantry, I would watch that for 19 seasons. Guns and power and the weird masculine redemption fantasy of white dudes getting back to running things has never meant as much to me as abundant, well-organized food. The apocalypse I dreamed of was different and presented a different kind of consolation. I was in the Pioneer Valley, in the western part of my home Commonwealth of Massachusetts, an important place in my life. I was sitting in the Montague Book Mill, a used bookstore inside a creaky old sawmill that looks about to collapse into the shallow little river that once powered it. This is where I had written a lot of my first two books, and I was now trying to start another. But I was having trouble, because I had just realized that I was not going to live forever. This thought had never occurred to me before. I am a straight white man, the hero of almost every story I had ever encountered. And what's more, I'm an only child. The idea that the world could continue without me was not only unimaginable, it was insulting. But in that moment, something shifted. I was upstairs at the book mill, alone, sitting at a nicked wooden table before two open windows, their glass wavy with age. The door behind me was open and full of sun, the ancient eaves above me cold with summer shadow. The little river giggled outside as it slowly consumed its rocky foundation. I was halfway through my 40th year. Mustache 2 was in graying bloom, and I was writing a book in a used bookstore, exactly where books go to die. And then, it was a physical sensation that I remember. Suddenly I was gripped, just above my stomach, by the dumb, offensive truth. Everything ends. Nothing lasts. Not even John Hodgman. This is a truth so obvious that we build whole world religions, grandly spangled with art and rituals and distracting hypocrisies, in order to avoid thinking about it. And if we do not succumb to religion or myth, we tell ourselves other wild stories to make us feel better. The story I started that day was That Is All, the last book I wrote before this one. It was the third in a trilogy of fake facts and invented history that I originally wrote for a general audience, but had found a particular following among strange 13-year-olds. So I thought I would treat those kids to a comedy book about everyone on Earth dying all at once. Now, I know that sounds like a big literary innovation, but the truth was the end times were trending. Everyone was talking about how the ancient Mayans had calculated that the world would end in December 2012. I just added some other equally plausible elements, a giant ravaging swarm of stray dogs, a massive tsunami of blood, and eventually the earth cracking in half to release a giant magical toad at its center on 12/21/12. Nothing you wouldn't find in any bad Google translation of the Book of Revelation, but it comforted me. Unlike the zombie apocalypse, global annihilation offered a different, better comfort. Not that I could escape death, But then when I died, I got to take everyone else out with me. I may not have been there at the beginning of creation, but I would be there to turn the lights off. And this just felt right. You may have noticed the world did not end on December 21st, 2012, as the Mayans and I predicted. Very embarrassing. I blame the Mayans. Looking back, it was probably stupid of me to trust the math of an ancient people. Their calendars were made of stone, and they couldn't even make smooth pyramids. But on December 22nd, I was disappointed. Obviously, I didn't actually want my wife and children and everyone else to be crushed by a giant, ancient, unspeakable god crawling across the earth. But that said, I hadn't really made any plans for the world not ending. And now I was stuck. I had lined up no work for 2013. And honestly, what more was there for me to do? I had just written 1,000 pages of fake facts. It was every joke I knew how to tell, every story I had inside of me. And those pages, against all reasonable expectation based on my age, experience, neck fat, and asymmetric eyes, put me on camera next to my hero, John Stewart, and then in a series of ads for Apple. I never met my other hero, Steve Jobs, because I was shy, and I still thought we had all the time in the world. I had slept in the bungalow where John Belushi died. I had sipped martinis in the East Hampton home called Grey Gardens out of glasses I found in the cupboard monogrammed EBB for Edith Bouvier Beale. I had been hugged by Chuck D of Public Enemy. I had not only met the 44th President of the United States, Barack Obama, but also goddamn George R.R. Martin, who sought me out at a Hollywood post-Emmy party, reached in his pocket, and handed me a coin of the faceless man. And if that means anything to you, then you will also find it meaningful that at the same party, exactly 1 year later, he reached in his pocket and handed me another one. Yes, George R.R. Martin carries around pocket caches of coins of the faceless man, just to blow nerd minds at parties. And I have that information because of the insanely fortunate, surreal life beyond imagining that had grown out of my books, my life's work, that was now complete. Plus, I had a perfect, beautiful, challenging wife, healthy children who cared nothing for sports, and I had been on Battlestar fucking Galactica. Sorry, kids, but I had to say it. Honestly, the world should have exploded just to punish me for my good luck. Let's step back for a moment so I can offer you a little footnote. When I wrote that I had a perfect, beautiful, challenging wife, my wife, who read an early version of this, asked me to not use the word challenging, because when applied to women especially, it's often read as difficult and unlikable. As usual, she was quite right. And what's more, she is not those things. So on the one hand, her literal challenge of me was well-founded, but come on, Kath, it's a challenge. She also rejected the word perfect, and rightly so. That's both bad writing and a sentimental lie. Nobody's perfect, so I hereby strike that one out. But I refuse to strike out beautiful. So there. I don't want to reduce our marriage to a footnote, but this is not a book about marriage or family. Both because I respect my loved ones' private lives, and because I am very selfish. This is a book about me, at what I hope is the beginning of the second half of my life, and not the brief final tenth, but I don't know. I am an only child to the end, I suppose. And at the end, we all are. I also don't want to reduce our marriage to a footnote because I promised my publisher no more footnotes. In my previous books, I went a little footnote crazy, so I'm only doing this one. This is a straightforward book of straightforward true stories, so this will be the only footnote. Let its singularity speak to the importance of my wife and children and our lives together to me, despite all evidence here, and my gratefulness and dedication to them. For the depth of my feelings on this subject, I will quote a famous writer, a better writer, speaking of his own marriage. I know my own wife will approve because this is her favorite author, and here is the quote. Sometimes I feel as though I were a diver who had ventured a little beyond the limits of safe travel under the sea and had entered the strange zone where one is said to enjoy the rapture of the deep. end quote. If you want to find out who wrote it, you should Google it. He's really good. So that is the end of the footnote. Now back to the main text. I was saying the world should have exploded, but it didn't. The world was ending, yes, but only in the same slow, dumb way it always has been. And so I suddenly had years to fill. I didn't know how many, and I didn't know how. And I had a sad, guilty sense that filling those years would just be taking up space, hogging air and attention that in a fair life would be better apportioned to younger, hungrier souls. So, yeah, why not grow a beard? When you don't know what to do in your life, there is always the mystery of what happens if you just do nothing. What if I just stop taking care of myself? And if I do, what will come out of my face? My beard is the answer. You cannot see it, but I must make you see it, so you will know my shame. Its luscious portions gather on my neck, of course, and terminate to a devilish point on my chin. On the sides, it looks like salt and pepper ants climbing up and down my face. The mustache and soul patch of yore are still there, but still refusing to connect to each other or any other part of the madness on my face, probably because they hate each other. In the great unmatching bald expanses of my cheeks, there are strands of lone, black, tough, wiry hairs, like the kind Jeff Goldblum manifested when he first began transforming into the fly in David Cronenberg's The Fly. Now, if you understand that reference, you will also understand this one. I look like the kind of person who invented a teleportation pod and used myself as the first test subject. But what I didn't know as I locked the door on the pod and threw the switch, that I was not alone in there. I had not noticed that a man had snuck into the pod with me. An actual man, with an actual beard. And after our molecular intermingling in the air between the first pod and the second, I am the wretched, half-hirsute chimera that emerged on the other side. I knew it would turn out this way. I knew it would be terrible. But I was compelled to grow my beard. All men have to grow a beard at some point because they wonder, who is the secret man that lives inside of them? Who will they meet in the mirror when they stop shaving? And they wonder if that beard man is better than them. If that elder sage or fantasy wizard or feral mountain man will be wiser than they are. And when they are lost, if that dude will light up his staff and guide them through the dwarven mines and out of the wilderness. Based on the overall effect of my beard, the secret man inside me, it turns out, is the part-time bookkeeper for the Church of Satan. I look like the guy who goes in every other Monday and goes to the ledger and complains to the High Magus that they're spending too much money on red candles. And what is this? $3,500 for cleaning? What's that for? Oh, the sex magic ritual? Ugh, Jesus Christ, you guys. Oh, sorry about that. I meant Hail Satan. Please don't kill me with knives. This man is not the man I expected to live inside of me. But I am counting on him all the same. This is a book about me and my beard, wandering through three wildernesses. First, the Green Mountains of rural western Massachusetts, where I disposed of a good part of my youth. Second, the mercilessly painful beaches of coastal Maine, where I know I will eventually accept my death. And finally, the haunted forest of middle age that lies between them. And here is a second apology. I'm going to be honest with you. There are no fun fake facts in this book. While I may evade particular details and change some names in order to protect the privacy of those who did not ask to know me, the rest is all the mere awful truth about my dumb thoughts and feelings. And I'm sorry for this. It's all I have left. This is part one. Dump Jail. I'm from Brookline, Massachusetts, but I was technically born in a hospital in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So now you have a critical answer to many of my internet security questions. And as this book is about being honest with you, for once, I will also tell you that my mother's maiden name was Callahan. So enjoy my Amazon Prime account and all my money. But while both of these places, Brookline and Cambridge, are in the east, I've spent most of my adult life living part-time in the rural west of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This region is called, plausibly, Western Massachusetts, and more specifically the Pioneer Valley, which follows the Connecticut River north from Springfield and up to just south of the Vermont border. It's not a resort destination like the Berkshire Mountains, but instead it's the western edge of what amounts to Massachusetts' flyover country. The hills are beautiful, but not breathtaking, and medium-sized. They're crossed with little rivers and dotted with dead mills and foundries, and home to some little towns that are still thriving, and others where not one but both of the village churches are for sale and have been for years. Route 2, heading west to Williamstown, is a scenic route called the Mohawk Trail, a former Native American trade route. And if you have a desire to see Mohawk junk souvenir shops of questionable taste and authenticity, you have your choice between the one with the giant teepee that is maybe still open and the rest that have been closed and abandoned for my whole life. The valley is more fertile, home to a clutch of liberal arts colleges and rich plains of good land. The primary crop is tobacco. They grow it for two reasons: to sell as cigar wrappers, and to prove that every cliché you think you know about the North and South is probably wrong. There are also small family farms raising corn and grazing sheep and cattle. Some young utopians are growing incredible biodynamic lettuces, or roasting coffee, or brewing kombucha. Other young utopians are opening hopeful restaurants featuring these local ingredients and offering artisanal cocktail programs, trying to latch on to the farm-to-table movement, the latest attempt to rescue the region from the death of small American manufacture and the opioid epidemic. These enterprises should be supported, since the food is really good, and most Boston foodies are still skipping Western Massachusetts for Portland, Maine. When Anthony Bourdain came to Greenfield, the Franklin County seat, to film an episode of Parts Unknown, local restaurateurs relished a chance to show off their wares and maybe enjoy a huge Guy Fieri-like post-Bourdain boom. But instead, Anthony Bourdain spent most of his time talking about the town's heartbreaking addiction to heroin. To me, the image of the Pioneer Valley is three emu eggs nestled in a basket at the Whole Foods down by the colleges. Somebody, either a back-to-the-land liberal pioneer or a back-to-the-wall local hoping to keep his farm, had put his money into emu ranching. Emu was the meat of the future back in the 1990s. But then the emu bubble, a real thing, burst, leaving some poor soul with a flock of six-foot-tall sub-ostrich neo-dinosaurs with bad tempers and open head holes for ears, and they couldn't be sold and were now just leaving their eggs all over the place. Emu eggs are mutant, Dr. Seussian-looking things, the size of a candlepin bowling ball with a shell that is a surreal deep blue green. The produce guy at Whole Foods told me that a single egg will make an omelet that will serve 8 people. And with every word of that sentence, I got progressively closer to barfing. Those 3 eggs in a basket at Whole Foods spoke the words of the Pioneer Valley into my own ear holes. They said, "We are desperate dreamers, and we will try anything to survive." I don't know if anyone bought the emu eggs. I've never seen them in there again. Soon after I left for college, my mother and father bought a house here, just south of Vermont, in a very small town that I will not name for fear of you. It is not a fancy house. My mom wanted something on one of the little rivers that trickle through the hill towns, but those are hard to come by, as construction near the river is banned now, and the housing stock that remains sometimes gets washed away. So she settled on this house, a 1979 ranch home designed by an engineer instead of an architect, which means the one bathroom faces directly into the living room. It sits on the shady side of a hill in a sparsely populated rural community that advertises itself as a right-to-farm town on its sign, which means that if you smell manure, you're not allowed to complain about it. The house was inexpensive. It didn't sit on a river, but there was a sluggish brook, which quickly turned into a mosquito bog once the beavers got at it. It was my mom and dad's weekend home. They would drive 2 hours from Brookline on a Friday afternoon. My father would watch movies and make spaghetti, and my mom would smoke cigarettes and read mystery novels and eat Stouffer's cream chip beef. If they went outside, they'd maybe look at some old junk for sale in Barnes, or go to that one falling-down hotel on the Mohawk Trail that served day drinks to the snowmobilers and had those sausages that we liked. And then they'd head home. My mom knew how to live. Over the years, my then-girlfriend and I would visit them and enjoy the same things, including the cigarettes, very, very much. And then my girlfriend and I got married. A month later, my mom was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, and 8 months later, she died. My father attempted to go to the house a few times, but found it emotionally unbearable, and so he offered it to us for a dollar. At the time, I was a freelance writer for magazines, and I think my father presumed, reasonably, that this would be my one chance to ever have an asset in my life. He asked if we could keep up with the taxes and expenses, and the answer to that was no. But I did have a dollar, and I missed my mom, so I took the deal. My wife and I have now owned the house for twice as long as my mom did. And because my wife teaches high school, and I am barely self-employed, we can enjoy it for long stretches of the summer and winter in the exact ways my mom and dad did. Movies, cream chip beef, but now minus the smoking. We compensate for the smoking part with gin and Scrabble. When we had children, we were forced to acknowledge that the house had an outside, and so we started squinting out into the sun and getting to know our neighbors, who are scattered and few. Our daughter and the daughter of the family across the street became best friends when they were three, and even now as teens, their brains lock together the moment they see each other, and they speak a kind of twin language to each other from morning to night, while my son is over there beating the shit out of the Penguins goons in Arkham Asylum for the PlayStation 3 for the same period of time. It's an incredible privilege to give them access to such a different way and pace of life. For example, in Brooklyn, we don't even have Arkham Asylum. We even thought about moving full-time to the Pioneer Valley when it became clear that a family of four could not live in New York City on a teacher's income plus the money earned from 750-word magazine articles on cheese and barn jackets. But then, I went on television, and my father's worst fears for me receded. Thanks to television, we were able to spiff up the house and finish a basement bedroom. We didn't think to move that bathroom, but we did add a deck off the kitchen, offering a pretty good view of the hills and the bog when the sun is up. When darkness falls, it is total. And at night, before bed, I check the basement and garage for serial killers. After more than a decade of this, I've begun thinking they aren't going to show up. It is peaceful. We've not been back to the house in Massachusetts for a while, for reasons that I'll explain later in this book. And this makes me anxious, for all kinds of existential reasons, but also because the last time we were there, I left four large contractor garbage bags full of rotting food waste piled in the garage. This has become something of a habit of mine. It's not a responsible thing to do if you own a house or simply want to be part of civilization. It is absolutely an invitation to a raccoon heist. But leaving the garbage to steep and decay for months in the garage is my system. And I have a good reason for my system, which is this. There's no garbage collection in rural western Massachusetts, so you have to drive your garbage to the dump, and I don't feel like it. I never feel like going to the dump, because it is a 25-minute drive away. It's very rarely open, and when it is open, it all the time scares me. It's terrifying. Look, it's not intrinsically scary. It's really just a small transfer station, a compound of recycling sheds and dumpsters and barrels circling one big pit with a compactor in it. And look, I like systems, and I enjoyed perfecting the protocol of each hole and sticky chamber, figuring out which is for redeemables and which is for cardboard and which is for corrugated cardboard. I will happily lose myself in the madness of small distinctions. And the fact is that sorting out your life garbage and getting rid of it is always cathartic. Even if the task is merely literal throwing away of garbage, and it makes your car and hands smell like old milk and beer. Yes, the yellowing Stonehenge of refrigerators loitering by the large items shed was creepy, Removing their doors only makes them seem hungry for children to crawl into them and die. But obviously those refrigerators could do no harm now. And then there was the sad city of broken and abandoned toys, all lined up on the low concrete wall by the compactor. Parents don't want to throw toys away. It's their children's youth. So they lay the evidence of time passing here like offerings and mark them free and walk away. And I am sure by the end of the day, all those toys are just thrown into the hole by the men who work at the dump. But this isn't really scary. It's just monumentally sad. It gives you something to think forlornly about as you drive home. No, my terror of the dump was deeper and began the day my father handed me the keys to the house and he said, "There is no garbage collection in rural Western Massachusetts. You have to take the garbage to the dump." And then he said the chilling words I will never forget. He said, "If the men who work at the dump ask you where you live, tell them you are staying with Jackie Brown." Now, this is not a Quentin Tarantino reference. My father is not a big fan of the movie Jackie Brown. Rather, he was referring to an actual person, Jackie Brown, who had been my mother's colleague in the nursing department of Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, and later one of her closest friends. Jackie grew up in Greenfield at the bottom of our hill, and still had a house, a small box perched over the North River that she had bought with a friend over in the neighboring town of Coleraine. My dad isn't a liar. We had stayed with Jackie Brown many times when I was younger, the three of us going out to see Jackie and sit around and do nothing by the river. My mom and father would take the second bedroom, and I would sleep on the sofa by the cast iron stove. Jackie was our introduction to the area. Her house was the inspiration for my mom's own half-failed quest to find her own sit-around-and-do-nothing house next to a river that ended with this house by a bog, where I now stood with my father, confused about what I was supposed to say to the men at the dump. My father explained that the dump is not in our town, but in this neighboring town of Coleraine, and so technically, we were not allowed to dump our garbage there. But it's still the nearest dump, so should the guys at the dump ever ask where I lived, I was supposed to lie to them and say, "I am staying with Jackie Brown in Coleraine." I did not like any of this. As I've mentioned, I am an only child. This makes me a member of the worldwide, super smart, afraid of conflict narcissist club. And let me emphasize afraid of conflict. Since I had no siblings to routinely challenge or hit me, and equally no interest in playing sports, I had grown up without any experience in conflict. I therefore had no reason to imagine that confrontation of any kind, ranging from fighting to kissing, was not probably fatal. So, I didn't want to break the rules of the dump. I loved rules. In any situation, I wanted to know what the rules were, so that I could follow them perfectly, thus assuring not merely approval, but also love from every single person on earth. So, no, I did not like being put in a position where I would have to lie to some dumpmen. The chance of failure seemed high, the chance of unanimous global affection ready to plummet. I'm still not sure why I didn't simply ask where we were supposed to dump our trash. The answer is over there in Greenfield. Perhaps on some level, for once in my life, I wanted to challenge myself. And so after a long period of hoarding garbage anxiously in the garage, I would finally take a deep breath, shove it all into the rental car, and drive to the dump. As I drove, I would rehearse my story. I am staying with Jackie Brown in Coleraine. I am staying with Jackie Brown in Coleraine. I am staying with Jackie Brown in Coleraine. I would say this out loud in the car, over and over, changing inflection and emphasis like an actor or a schizophrenic. I'd try to sound confident. Sometimes I would yell it. I did this for 7 years. The muttering drive to the dump, the anxious pre-show sorting and dumping of recycling before the moment of truth, circling up to throw the contractor bags into the big hole, all illegally bearing Town of Coleraine garbage tags, and then, illegally, buying new tags from the dumpmen in their little toll booth next to the trash compactor, and always waiting for the question, "Where do you live?" 7 years passed. My wife and I had our first child, and the dumpman never asked. But then, something happened. Jackie Brown died. Like my mom, Jackie was diagnosed with cancer. Like my mom, she succumbed quickly. I didn't get to say goodbye to her. Maybe I didn't try hard enough. Maybe I couldn't go through saying goodbye again so soon. But I would be lying if I told you that in all of my shock and mourning, I also didn't think to myself, "Oh shit, there goes my alibi." Now what was I going to tell the dumpman? This is a small town. Surely the dumpman would know soon that no one would be staying with Jackie Brown and Coleraine ever again. So I had to come up with a new story, and I had to come up with it all on my own. I was a grown-up now, and a homeowner. I couldn't rely on my father for lies anymore. I was nervous, but I am a storyteller by training, and so I set to work, and I did it. I came up with a new story to rehearse over and over again on the way to the dump, and this is the story. I would arrive at the dump, and the dumpman would say, "Where do you live?" And I would say, "Good question, guys. And here is the answer. You know how my family and I used to stay with Jackie Brown and Coleraine? Oh, you don't know, because you never asked. And that seems very rude to me, because I was always ready to tell you. But let's put that behind us now. Because this is a small town in rural western Massachusetts, I am sure you have heard that Jackie Brown has died. Yes, it is very sad. And now, my family and I are helping to clean out her house and get it ready to sell. And this, and here I would gesture to the contractor bags, this is her death garbage." At which point they would be so reverent and ashamed that they would step aside and never doubt me again. This story sustained me for quite a while, and my drives to the dump were peaceful. Years passed this way. My wife and I had a second child. But by the birth of our son, my death garbage story began to expire. Jackie's house was only three rooms small. How many old magazines and mattresses and bedding and memory could we still be pulling out of it? What's more, as I became more familiar with the culture of the area, I gradually and darkly realized that my story was never plausible. Because I had come to observe, should a person die in rural western Massachusetts, you do not clean out her house and get it ready to sell. You take what you want, padlock it shut, and leave it for nature to reclaim. And so now, I was flying blind, with no story. But even so, the dumpman never asked. Not for 7 years, when the dump was overseen by the sunken-cheeked guy with the long cigarettes who looked like Dr. Johnny Fever from WKRP in Cincinnati. And not for the next 7 years, when that guy was replaced by the guy who looked like Larry the Cable Guy, but even so, you liked him. They were always nice, and I'm sorry I never learned their real names. It was only recently, after 14 years, that I realized they were never going to ask, because they do not care. They work at the dump. They probably are not paid well enough just to work at the dump, never mind worry about the provenance of the bags of food waste and mouse bodies that you've come to throw in their hole. Coming from Park Slope, Brooklyn, where I now live, it never occurred to me that humans, when armed with authority, no matter how small, would not use that power to sanctimoniously cudgel their neighbors at every opportunity. I've never joined the Park Slope Food Co-op, for example. I've heard too often of the shamings that are doled out if you request that they stock the morally incorrect brand of hummus. Even when no clear authority applies, the residents of Park Slope stand ready to scold. I once barely dodged a speeding car as it blew through a light on a residential street, and I yelled at the driver to slow down. This yelling doesn't count as confrontation, by the way. He was long gone. I was safe. I yelled at him to slow down, only to be immediately yelled at myself by a woman on a bicycle because I was standing in the bike lane while I was yelling. We both agreed that a speeding car was our common enemy, especially right near the elementary school that my own children attended, and probably hers too. But we would clamber atop the bodies of 100 rundown children if it would help us reach the moral high ground first. So it took me almost a decade and a half to understand that in rural western Massachusetts, at the dump, they're not interested in humiliating you to make themselves feel better. That's a Brooklyn thing. The dumpmen just want you to toss your trash and enjoy yourself. Go enjoy the day and have a lollipop before you go. They always have lollipops, a little basket of them on the windowsill of their office. They're the brand of lollipops called Dum Dums, as if to say, "Congratulations, Dum Dum, you did it. You threw your trash away." And you would think that all of this would come as a relief to me. But now I actually felt worse. What happened to the rules? Had the rules changed and now my trash was legal? Or was there never a rule against dumping across town lines? Or was there still a rule, but was it an unspoken rule? The worst kind of rule. Whatever the case, it became clear that my father's fear was always fictional. I am certain now that the dump men never ever asked him where he lived either, never. But then, for some reason, maybe 20 years ago, he woke up in the middle of the night, in the sweaty grip of a dark imagining. What if they ask me where I live? What will I say? I don't want to go to dump jail. I have to come up with something. Something to tell them. I have to craft a story. A story so good that I can pass it on to my son. Like a monogrammed wristwatch of neurosis that I can shove up his rectum. That, by the way, is a Quentin Tarantino reference, not Jackie Brown, Pulp Fiction. Now look, I love my father. It's not his fault that he made up a fear, and in order to make it feel more real to him, he gave it to me. I mean, I was obviously built to receive it. As a father now myself, it's sobering to think about how the smallest comments will ripple through your children's lives, some leaving permanent warps. I wish I could tell you. That is why I tell my own children now not to lie to the dumpman, to know there is no dump jail. I wish I could tell you my children now throw the garbage in the hole unafraid, that they look the dumpman in the eye and address them respectfully by name while I watch from the car proudly, though always ready to gun the engine and abandon them should things go south. But the truth is, my kids don't do that. They just sit in the car. They read Archie comics, surf the internet. They wait for me to dump the bags and come back with the dum-dums. I must console myself in the certainty that I am helping them and damaging them in other ways I cannot see. Mongering. I don't like riding on city buses. Those things can go anywhere. There are no tracks, and their routes and stops, we all know it's a collective fiction. What if something goes wrong? Now, I'm confident that even if the driver of a bus decided to try psychedelic mushrooms for the first time that morning, I probably would not die. No Hyundai or streetlight can fight a city bus. They're the blunt, slow, armored whales of the streets. But if the bus driver took psychedelic mushrooms, I could end up at some destination I did not choose, which to me is worse than death. That said, I am not only a creature of pure fear. In fact, growing up as an only child gives you a unique, stupid kind of courage, one that's doubled if you're white and well-off and well-loved by parents who love each other. I had a protective confidence in my own specialness, which allowed me, for example, to grow my flat, greasy hair to my shoulders, put a black fedora on top of it, wear a bolo tie, carry a briefcase, and go to high school that way, every day. By 10th grade, I was cultivating all sorts of loathsome affectations. I read the plays of Athel Fugard and Tom Stoppard. I played the viola, because it was less popular than the violin, and then I added the clarinet, because the saxophone is a little bit of a cliché. It was important that I play two instruments, so I didn't get good at either one, lest I ruin my status as a teen genius dilettante. I do not know why I was not bullied more. I think I may have presented too many hate targets for bullies to get a bead on. One time I was standing outside WMFO, the Tufts University radio station, where I had talked myself into a Friday afternoon slot as a DJ. That was the sort of thing I would do then. Mostly the DJs were Tufts students, appropriately. But WMFO high-mindedly kept a few slots open for, quote, members of the community. Now, I would guess now they were supposed to go to marginalized voices in the community, working people from the neighborhood, local activists, not affluent high schoolers from Brookline who simply wanted to play the same Billy Bragg song over and over again. But somehow the station accepted me as a community member DJ, and now I had finished my shift and was starting the long walk to Porter Square to catch the train back home. There was a bus that would take me to Porter Square. I would not take it. As I was walking, a car full of angry townies pulled up alongside me. They stared hard at me for a while. The lead guy's dull, watery eyes searched me up and down as if to say, "Where do I even begin with this guy?" And finally he barked, "Liberal!" And they peeled out. That was the best he could do. It was fine. I couldn't really argue with them. My father had once worked for Mike Dukakis. I had been accused of being a fag maybe only 3 times, which for Massachusetts in the 1980s was an accomplishment. And one of those times, the accusation was actually a kindness. I was having lunch with my close high school friend Jason, and he asked me if I was gay. "Everyone is wondering," he said. "You don't seem to have any interest in girls, and you dress like Doctor Who." Well, I had to admit it made sense. But I wasn't gay, I told him. I felt bad about it. It might have made me more interesting. Of course, Jason was gay, but I didn't figure that obvious subtext out until years later, because then I was purposely stupid on such subjects. The truth was that all hugging and kissing matters made me very uncomfortable. What I really wanted was to skip sexual adolescence altogether and jump forward to the life of a sexless middle-aged bachelor that I felt destined to become. And, in large part, I succeeded. Both of my parents were the first of their families to go to college, Boston College, where they met. My father grew up in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. His father worked in a paper mill until he retired to a life of cribbage and long stretches of silence. My grandfather had converted to Catholicism to marry my Italian-American grandmother. She made good spaghetti sauce and sang Tiny Bubbles. Her sisters, one widowed, the other never married, lived across the street, where they collected cats and suspected that someone was sneaking in and stealing the copper pipes in the basement and replacing them with perfect non-copper replicas. This was not happening. My mom grew up in Philadelphia. She had one younger brother for a long time, until her parents felt guilty for using birth control and quickly had 5 more daughters. Catholics! They all lived in a 3-bedroom row home in northeast Philadelphia. Though my mother loved her family, she did a complete 180 from her life when she and my father married and settled into their careers. She gave up Catholicism and became an atheist. She had only one child and moved our tiny family into an enormous house. 22 beautiful, crumbling rooms that had most recently been a commune. I'll say that again. 22 rooms. I still don't believe it. My mom fixed up a bunch of it herself, and to afford it, she rented whole floors and wings out to graduate students and young doctors. And even then, we had more house than we could possibly need, and the three of us would wander around it, only occasionally bumping into one another. Only children have a special relationship with their parents if the parents aren't divorced. You're alone together in the big house of the world. And you quickly come to rely on each other for company as much as anything else. You spend a lot of time traveling together, going to movies together, watching Brideshead Revisited with your dinners on your laps together, and pretty soon you all feel like boarders in a big house. They're not your parents so much as they are your weird older roommates. I was 14 when a nursing colleague of my mom's, who had been renting some rooms in the house, moved out. Her area had been sectioned off with its own bathroom, living room, bedroom, even its own foyer. It was perfect. I announced my intention to give up my own perfectly spacious bedroom that I had never, ever had to share with anyone else, and now move into what amounted to a secret private apartment within my childhood home. After all, I said, I'm in high school now. I need the space. My parents did not object to this sick land grab. Maybe they didn't hear me from the other side of the dining room when I proposed it. Either way, I began setting up my new life. I took apart my old bunk bed from my old room. You know, all only children have bunk beds, obviously. The only child sleeps on the top bunk to at once embody his surfeit of resources and literalize his loneliness, the empty, siblingless space that follows them even to unconsciousness. I took that old bunk bed apart and I arranged the top and bottom bunks into an L-shaped sectional sofa in my new living room, and I added some corduroy upholstered bolster pillows to make it kind of a loungy situation. I scavenged a green shaded library lamp and an old school desk from somewhere, and I put a manual typewriter on top of that desk so I could type all of my thoughts. I had a fern. I still don't remember where that came from. Where'd I get a fern? They were everywhere in the 80s, I guess. An old steamer trunk from some sub-attic in the house was my coffee table. I put my parents' old black-and-white TV on top of it. And there I would retire of an evening, alone, to watch TV's bloopers and practical jokes, swirling a snifter glass of whole milk and simply murdering an entire box of Triscuits. A goddamn sophisticate. And from that home base, I would go out and explore the semi-metropolises of Boston and Cambridge and suck the thin marrow from their bones. I would go to cafes and read Julio Cortázar alone. I would peruse the early work of Nick Kershaw at Planet Records in Kenmore Square. I would go to the first Newbery Comics and be scared by photographs of Wendy O. Williams and purchase Art Spiegelman's Raw. At a midday animation festival at the off-the-wall cinema in Central Square, I saw Vincent, the first short by a then-unknown filmmaker called Tim Burton. That man is going places, I said to nobody, because I was by myself. One time, coming home on the Red Line from Harvard Square, I was unwrapping a new cassette I had picked up at the Harvard Coop, an anthology of jazz violin. An attractive young woman next to me said, "Oh, I have that tape. It's great." "Good," I said, "and nothing else." I put on my headphones and stared straight ahead, because as much as I wanted credit for making myself into such a fascinating fake adult, on some level even I knew I was a pretentious weirdo, and she would be better off not talking to me. I had no curfew. My parents both bought my grown-up act and saw through it for its sad yearning. What kind of trouble was I going to get in? Worst case scenario, I might see some provocative installation art. And so I traveled out and back day and night fearlessly. And I would do all of this by train and not by bus. Because if your subway train conductor does shrooms in the morning, you will probably die. But you will die on the way, between two well-defined stops. It's not risk I'm afraid of. It's ambiguity. On those trains, I knew where I was going. When I stopped faking it and grew up to become an actual physical adult, it was terrible. After high school, I went to Yale. If you're not convinced of what an easy time I've had of it, witness this. I took no loans, I needed no financial aid, my parents had saved assiduously, and I punished their good deed by studying literary theory. Not literature. Literary theory. Literature would be too practical. I was less interested in books than I was in the concept of books. And that is still true. I mentioned that my mom was a nurse. That makes sense. I understand what that is. But even now, I have a hard time explaining what my father did during his long and obviously successful career. I know he was an executive at an early computer company in Massachusetts, and later he oversaw a state-funded investment fund that invested in local emerging tech companies. I'm just using my brain to force my mouth to say those words. I don't know what they mean. I never really understood what they translated to, in how he spent his time and whom he worked with and how he felt about it. My father is a businessman doing business things for businesses was always my best guess, and it still is even now that he's retired. When I went to college to spend the money that he and his mystery occupation had raised on my behalf, he asked only one thing, that I take a single course in bookkeeping. It was his only request that I take a moment to peer into his world. Of course I didn't do it. Sorry, Dad. Instead, I read historic comic strips as literature and worked at a video store and lived in a basement. I went to London for one semester on a drink abroad program of my own devising, and I got a job at a cheesemonger's. I loved mongering that cheese. I would turn the cheeses over once in the morning and once in the afternoon to keep their moisture evenly distributed. And between those times, I would stand outside waiting for midday when the beautiful French teenagers would descend from the École Française at the top of the street to pillage the neighborhood for warm hunks of bread and massive chocolate bars. Oh, even their acne was beautiful. I liked Yale because its architecture was majestic and historic and largely fictional. On the tour for prospective students, I was informed that all the Gothic castles and red brick Georgian piles that make up the campus were designed at the same time, an imitation of the slow architectural accretions of Oxford and Cambridge. The shingles were buried for months to age them, the windows purposefully broken and repaired to seem old. That's when I fell in love. It was a set. It wasn't college so much as the concept of college. Imagine if the phony Hogwarts in the middle of the Universal Studios theme park granted real degrees along with alcohol. Now you feel it. Once I went to a party in a tomb. Yale was founded before the advent of the fraternity system, so the white men of generations past had to make up their own structures for sub-erotic bonding and pointless tribalism. That is why there are 18 a cappella singing groups at Yale. That is more a cappella than a city the size of New Haven could ever require, and no one seems to be doing anything about this problem. And also a half dozen or so senior secret societies, each with its own clubhouse called a tomb. Now, these tombs are old. They're stately, huge buildings that look like beautiful old public libraries, but with two distinctions. One, they are weirdly completely windowless. And two, they were not built like libraries for the betterment of all society, but instead the secret use of, originally, small groups of wealthy 18-year-old men who needed privacy in which to maybe organize the secret world government, but probably just drink and masturbate into a coffin. Skull and Bones is the most famous of these secret societies, particularly for the Illuminati meets Onanism angle. But I was not invited to Skull and Bones. I was invited to Book and Snake. And I was disappointed. But you dance with the secret society that brought you, I always say, and I was excited to see inside its tomb, this blank sepulchral temple to historic white privilege, and take its secrets into my eye holes. And I did it. But I don't remember what I saw. Reports from contemporaries confirm that I did make it inside the building and all the way up to the top of the stairs. But the luminous truth that pulsed there, plus a fair amount of grain alcohol I had consumed at a small pre-secret society tailgate I had hosted, conspired to overwhelm me. I fell backward down the stairs, where my head hit a portion of the floor hard, and that trauma grabbed whatever I had seen out of my brain and returned it to the void. I woke up in the hospital with no memory of ever going inside. I was impressed. These secret societies know how to keep their secrets. This was the first time my actions had ever made my parents cry. I listened to them crying on the payphone of the cross-campus library. After my fall, I knew they would get the ambulance bill, and I was a good boy, so I called to give them a heads up. I could have died, they pointed out. But I hadn't.